Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. April the 23rd is accepted as the day of the month in 1616 when Shakespeare died, and also by anecdotal confirmation that he died on his birthday. So 2016 is being remembered as the 400th anniversary of both those events. Whatever the date, the fact remains that the poet and his works are brilliantly alive. From his birthplace to Russia, the Orient, the Americas, to the Antipodes, he is not forgotten. Arkansas Shakespeare Theatre is well to the fore to mark the celebration. Rebecca Scallet, the company's producing artistic director, has chosen a right royal feast of plays and coincidentally is celebrating an anniversary of its own. This 2016 is the 10th season for Arkansas Shakespeare Theatre. Rebecca is my guest to speak of the whys and wherefores of the choices.
Yes, well, in addition to it being the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, it's also the 10th anniversary of Arkansas Shakespeare Theatre. It's our 10th season of producing plays here. So it was big for both of us. And so one of the things I decided to do was that up until this point, the past 9 years, we haven't repeated any of Shakespeare's plays. We've done all new ones. And so for this year, I said it was okay. Now is an okay time to repeat and go back to some of the ones we've done before. And I really wanted to pick plays that people were familiar with, that were beloved, that would really allow us to kind of blow it out and do it up big. And I think we've done that.
So are they all repeats or are you new ones?
Yes. So this A Midsummer Night's Dream actually premiered and began our very first season. So it's kind of nice to come back to that and do it again for the 10th season. And then Romeo and Juliet, we did the second season. New this year, West Side Story. We haven't done that musical before. That'll be our first time doing that.
And that has such a strong link to Romeo and Juliet anyway, that it's part of the canon in a way.
Absolutely. And I kind of always had it in my head since I got this job, since this was a theater that does musicals and Shakespeare, that I wanted to find a time to be able to do Romeo and Juliet and West Side Story together. And this just seemed like the perfect year to do it.
And when you play them that close, people will suddenly connect it, which when they go to see West Side Story, they might not think Romeo and Juliet.
That's right. My hope is that people who maybe haven't been to a lot of Shakespeare will come to West Side Story and then be excited to see Romeo and Juliet, to be able to see those connections and what the creators of West Side Story were drawing from in the play. And they really did a wonderful job of taking the basis of that story, the kernels there, and doing it in a different way. Mm-hmm. But that still stays very true to the original.
So to put another one with that, what Twelfth Night?
Twelfth Night is a short Shakespeare this year. Every year we do a one-hour adaptation aimed at families. And what brought Twelfth Night in, you know, Midsummer and Romeo and Juliet have a lot of interconnecting stories. One of the things I love about Midsummer actually is that the play within the play that concludes it, the story of Pyramus and Thisbe, is essentially Romeo and Juliet. It's another version of that star-crossed lovers story. So I just loved that tie-in there. And Twelfth Night is, while it doesn't have that same cursed love element, does have sort of this theme of the madness of love. And the things that people do when they're in love and the length that they go to for love that I think is very much present in all the other stories.
Now, they have comic characters, that
yes.
One, and Midsummer Night's Dream, and not really Romeo and Juliet.
Not so much. There's the character of Peter, who is one of the servants who would have been played, we think, by Will Kemp, who was one of the big Shakespearean clowns. So you can see there was an intention for that to be the comic relief of the show, but he's not really in very much of it. So it's pretty limited. There's not a lot of comic relief in Romeo and Juliet.
Right. How many of last year's successful choices of actor have you found is coming back?
There are many. I don't have the exact number, but we have many returning actors this year, including all of our artistic collective, which is a group of actors and also one director who are sort of have decided to make AST their artistic home. And so we go to them first when we have roles for them, and they bring creative projects to us. But so all of those members are going to be in the company this year. So many familiar faces to audience who have been coming to our shows for the last 10 years will recognize many of them, including Dan Matissa, who played our Bottom in the original Midsummer, is coming back and doing Bottom again for us. So that's really fun. But all of those are coming back. Several new people. Our Romeo is actually an actor who was in my first season 5 years ago as an intern and is now coming back and playing Romeo for us, a young man named Halston Mann. So great, great returning group.
Now, with you here sort of calling the shots as the artistic director of the series, the theater, how, when you bring in with this separate group that you go to first, do you discuss with him the roles that you have in mind, and he will sort of discuss with you and see if the two of you together, yes, have the same thought, or maybe there's a question now that you're discussing it?
Yes, absolutely. I think the way it's worked so far, and we're kind of figuring it out as we go, but is that I have that group of people and I'm looking for the best fits for them within the company. And some years there's not a fit, and that's part of it too, is we want them to feel like AST is their home and they're involved, even when maybe there's a year that there's not a fit. And with Shakespeare, particularly for women, that happens because there are so few female roles. But when we have those fits, we want to give them that opportunity. So, but it is a discussion and say, this is what I have in mind. Is that something that you're interested in? And then at the same time, I like for them to feel comfortable to come to me and say, hey, I really want to do this role. I've always wanted to play Richard III or Henry V. And given that they have that ownership in the festival, if I can give them that opportunity, I will.
Yeah. And you're not going to do much in the way of transplanting it into some place or time that is other than it was written for?
No, actually, my first year, this will be my first year doing a show in the original time. We usually do take our Shakespeare's and not modernize them, but put them in a different time period that we feel helps to highlight the play and make the play more comprehensible to a modern audience, make it maybe a little more relevant. So for A Midsummer Night's Dream, it's actually going to be set in the 1930s and is also going to be a very musical setting. So our actor who's playing Puck is a man named Jordan Cofftree, who's been with us before. He's part of that artistic collective. And he also writes original music, and he did the original music for our production of Twelfth Night and also for Two Gentlemen of Verona 2 years ago. So he's a fantastic performer and singer, and he's going to be doing original music for A Midsummer Night's Dream as well, and taking some of Puck's monologues, he's playing Puck, and turning those into songs, so adding more moments of music to the show that are already there. So I think that's really exciting. And then for Romeo and Juliet, we're doing it actually in the Italian Renaissance. So like I said, this is actually my first time doing a Shakespeare play when it's actually originally set. But I felt like with West Side Story already being kind of that retelling and modernizing of the story, it made the most sense to keep Romeo and Juliet in the original time period.
I'm not looking at the sheet of your season. Which do you play first, Romeo and Juliet?
A Midsummer Night's Dream opens first.
No, I mean of the two that are matching, West Side Story or
Romeo
and
Juliet? Which one opens first? West Side Story opens first.
And so that might be almost easier for people who haven't made the connection.
That's right.
To think as it begins to go into the story, this is something I hadn't expected, sort of thing.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I hope so.
Now, do you have any original music for the others?
We don't. With Romeo and Juliet, we'll be working on with music from the period, though we will be incorporating live performance into that as well. And actually, I lied, with Twelfth Night, there is also original music. Our director and adapter of Twelfth Night is writing music for that. That's going to be a very musical experience.
So when you have a musical, do you have a music director?
We do, yes. We use Mark Binns, who's a fantastic local. He does many of the shows at the Rep. He may have been in here before.
So that's getting into quite a variety of characters and situations. Did you choose them for that reason?
To present The variety, definitely. I like when I look at the seasons, because we play everything in repertory. So you can, there are two weekends where you can see all the plays at once if you so choose. And so I really like the plays to be in conversation with each other, so that if you see more than one, you're thinking about the other one and noticing the similarities and the differences, and also get to enjoy that experience of watching an actor play two really different roles. I think kind of funnily, our Maria in West Side Story is also playing Mariah in Twelfth Night, and just two very different types of characters, and really fun to get to see her make those transformations, and all the actors work in different ways and sing and dance and do Shakespeare is really
fun. Now, had you all that in mind when you selected them, or when you got in touch with the people that you were bringing in, or did you find that some of your concepts altered slightly and you'd move from one character to another or one play to another?
It really, I try to kind of have in my head when I pick the season how certain shares might work between the plays, but it never worked out that way, because when you actually find the actors, they're all unique and their skill sets are different, and so you look for just the best fit for who that person is. So it really does just change based on who the actors are.
And of course, the actors themselves grow and change. And what you saw last year with certain people doing certain things that you thought of retrospectively would be perfect for such and such and so and so. And when you finally get them all together and you're talking at the very beginning, getting almost like not an audition, but just run through with certain things, that all of a sudden it clicks, well, I think this might do better reversing or...
That's true. Yes, I have had those thoughts before, though. Unfortunately, with our contracts, once we get into rehearsal, we're stuck with the parts that we've already assigned. So there's no changing around at that point. So I do my best to try to really get people in their right parts before we start. And I think for the most part, we do a good job with that.
Where do you get what you can put on your players in what's in your mind of what you'd like?
Well, we have some really fantastic costume designers that we bring in. And then it's a combination of building costumes, and we'll build usually the sort of the lead characters. We'll make costumes from them from scratch out of what the designers come up with. Then we have some stock costumes from our past shows. We'll borrow things when we can, or buy some pre-made things. There's actually quite a few pre-made doublets online that you can get. So just kind of putting it all together, looking at the budget and seeing what fits. But we have a full costume shop that we have on site that comes together every summer to work with those designers and make the costumes happen.
And is this all in Conway?
It's all in Conway, yes. So we build all our scenery, make all our costumes, have a crew working on the lighting and the sound. So we bring over 100 people, actually, to Conway every summer to make this festival happen.
Do you do a lot of traveling through the year to go and see people while they're performing in other places, in other roles?
I don't usually get to see them perform other places, but I do try to travel. I go to Chicago every year and do auditions there. And so I try to cast everyone from a live audition and having met them. And sometimes I do get to see them in productions. I also go to different colleges and graduate schools, and I'm able to cast people from those as well. And then we also cast some people from videotape. Both our Tony and Maria for West Side Story were just videotaped auditions, because we were looking for some really specific types of actors for that.
What about the actors that come to Little Rock for regular straight plays like The Rep and Theatre Squared and others? Do you keep in touch with them and get a chance to see some of them in action?
I do. I definitely try to see as many of the local shows as I can. And there often are actors that I get to see that I'm very interested in, and got to actually have a wonderful conversation with the actor who was here playing Macbeth, who's somebody who I think is really talented, and have to wait for the right opportunity that there might be a fit for him in the future. But we love to get to see people that way. And also the local actors that we have here. There's a really strong and growing talent pool in the Little Rock, Central Arkansas area, and probably even more when you expand out to Northwest Arkansas that I don't know about. As much as I can, I really do like to try to use local performers as well and mix them with the actors that we're bringing in from New York and Chicago.
And it's rather fun for you to sit in the audience and not realize you don't have to do anything at getting enjoy
yes,
it.
Yes, yes. It is nice to appreciate other people's work. Yes, definitely.
Yes. And the musicals, I would think, that you've chosen have proven so successful in other places that it's just a question of adapting your space.
That's right. Yes, I hope. West Side Story is obviously very beloved and has been very successful in the past. So yeah, it's fitting it to our space, fitting it to our needs in terms of, again, having those performers that can sing and dance and do Shakespeare and putting all of those things together. But yeah, we're not typically with the musical, we haven't been trying out new material. It's just finding the right shows that are going to really speak to the other Shakespeare productions and fit together well.
And you have the total freedom to use music other than what is chosen from somebody else's show, except for something like West Side Story, where the story and the music are so much a composite, it would be dangerous to try and move it.
Yes, no, and illegal, I think.
Yes. But given that the play is the thing, you can, research the type of player that you're bringing in. And as you say, you've got one who creates wonderful music. So you get a total package in
a way. That's right.
If he's also part of the acting company as well.
Yes. Yes. We've been very, very lucky having some talented people in the company that have that skill set. And I think that's one of the things I really enjoy about Shakespeare. Unlike a lot of modern plays and musicals that are copyrighted and there's a lot of rules about how you use the material. With Shakespeare, it's long out of copyright, even though, of course, you're not going to completely change and redo it. I'm very respectful of the text. But there's a lot of freedom in how you present it, and you can make changes like presenting a monologue as a song, and no one's going to stop you. And it can really open up the text and, I think, bring Shakespeare's work to life and honor Shakespeare's work and intentions in a really fun and exciting way.
Yeah. And I was just thinking while you were talking, the movie of Henry V that Branagh did, where they altered the death of Falstaff, made much more sense in the movie than it does in the play.
And there are things, and there are lots of things in Shakespeare that are perplexing, confusing. And I think that I don't see a problem with changing, moving things around, maybe adding a silent scene that helps to explain things, particularly with some of the histories and things where a modern day audience doesn't have all of that background information going into it. I think as somebody who directs Shakespeare, part of my job is to do whatever I can to help get across that story. And sometimes that does mean mixing things up a bit.
That was Rebecca Scallet, producing artistic director of Arkansas Shakespeare Theatre. The season opens June 10th and 11th with Midsummer Night's Dream on the lawn across from the UCA President's House in Conway, a new location, at 7:30 p.m. West Side Story, Romeo and Juliet, and Twelfth Night will be in Reynolds Hall. All four plays will be presented in repertory style June 17th through July the 9th. For tickets and more information, call 866-810-0012 or visit arkshakes.com. An Art Up special update. In honor of Shakespeare's 400th anniversary, Arkansas Shakespeare Theatre and the University of Central Arkansas are proud to host one of the few remaining editions of the 1623 first printing of Shakespeare's collected works. The First Folio, the book that gave us Shakespeare. The exhibit is free and open to the public at the Baum Gallery of Art on the UCA campus, June 7th through July the 12th, Tuesdays through Saturdays, 12:30 through 7:30 p.m. More details on the folio on next week's Art Scene. Arkansas Rep closes its 15-16 season with a world premiere, Windfall. It's also the last production for the Rep under Bob Hupp's leadership as he moves on to Syracuse, New York. Windfall is directed by Jason Alexander and opens next Friday. Sarah Weitz-Kotichek, KUAR News team member, interviewed Mr. Alexander and gives this report.
Mr. Alexander, thank you so much for speaking with me today about your work on Windfall here in Little Rock.
My pleasure.
Can you explain a bit about the play? I understand it's about some disgruntled workers in a data processing company who sort of take things into their own hands. You know, what's exciting to you about this story?
Well, first of all, it's a brand new play, so it's really cool to pick away at something that no one has cracked before, because every show is a mystery. You got to figure out what works, what doesn't work, how to do it. So that's fun, because nobody has a blueprint for it. But the play itself should relate to people on a lot of levels. It is about people working in a very sort of mind-numbing, soul-sucking, dead-end job. And they work for a guy who's incredibly abusive. And they have formed their own alliances to survive. And you think those alliances will support you and keep you sane and keep you emotionally healthy. And one of the things they do to bond with each other is they play the lottery, the way a lot of offices do. A lot of people will just, you know, they'll throw in their $5 a week and they'll go, hey, if we hit it, we'll split it. And in this case, they take an extraordinary risk beyond their means to win it big. And because of that, these tensions arise, and all those alliances and all those relationships and all that support turns on a dime. And the play is ultimately about the destructive power of greed and money and, you know, how dreams and wishes and that for which you have nothing you can do. Scooter, the playwright, believes that the lottery is basically a giant scam. It's bad gambling, as he says, because nothing that you bring to the table, it has nothing to do with your personality, your smarts, your merit, nothing. So he feels it's a ridiculous way to dream about value and dream about success, and that the realities of the situation, once it falls apart, all has to do is proof positive that these relationships were not sound, that they weren't real, that greed corrupts all and corrupts absolutely. And the play becomes very frenzied and crazy, and people wind up doing very, very bad things.
So most of our listeners will probably know you primarily from Seinfeld and all many other aspects of your career, but can you tell me a bit about how you got into directing and how you were drawn to work on this project in particular? Do you have a relationship pre-existing with a writer?
So directing has been a part of my life since college. I went to Boston University, and I was an acting and directing major. I've always been intrigued with directing because it's you take the job you do as an actor, and then you multiply it by every number of actors and the writer and all the design people. You just get to deal with a lot more people. A show, a movie, a television show, a play, they're all a puzzle. How are we going to do it? And actors only get to provide one piece of the puzzle. Directors get to sort of step back and look at all the pieces and go, oh, I think if we assemble it this way, it might be pretty. And that's a lot more fun for me than the joy of performance you don't get as a director, but you get a lot of other joys instead. How I came to this play is, this is the first play that my friend Scooter, and I know he sounds like a little kid with a beanie cap on, but he's actually a grown and wonderful man. Scooter Peach wrote this play, and Scooter is by profession a composer. He has written a lot of music for reality television and some popular songs and whatnot. But he's been a prolific playwright for a number of years, but he's never had anything of his own produced. And I've read many of his plays, and they're all interesting, good characters, good ideas. This one I thought was particularly further along. And I met Scooter through our mutual friend Brian Cranston. Brian was interested in being in another of Scooter's plays and asked if I would direct it. And then Brian's career kind of went through the ceiling, and he just didn't have time to do that play. And Scooter and I have remained friends, and I saw a reading of this play, because he wrote it, and then he just wanted to hear actors read it so he could see what he had. And I went to that reading and said, I think you may really have something here. And then we started working together, and I started guiding him through some rewrites, that's how it's developed. But it's great fun. If I could make 80% of my career directing at this point, I would do it. It's just that when you try to establish, I've been an actor for so long primarily, that when you say, well, I'm kind of directing now, there's a whole bunch of people who have been directing all along, and they're on the list ahead of you. So you have to do something notable and successful, and then you move up the list. But, you know, it's all fun.
So I know that you've done comedy throughout your career, and this has been pegged as a dark comedy. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a bit what that means?
A dark comedy is kind of one where you hate yourself for laughing, because it is, the comedy is coming at great expense for the characters who are in it. So it's not a lighthearted comedy where you have, I'm trying to think of a good lighthearted comedy, in the classical sense would be Cyrano de Bergerac. So this silly man is in love with this beautiful woman, and he doesn't know how to speak to her, so he hires this ugly man who's an amazing wordsmith, and the girl falls in love with the words and overlooks the man's ugliness. And it's all very lighthearted and fun, and nobody gets hurt, you know, or at least not profoundly hurt. You never sit there and go, oh, I feel really bad now, if you're in the audience. A dark comedy is the stakes are much higher. People are really getting hurt. The things that you're laughing about can be violent, they can be criminal, they can be people's ugliest emotions, and you're laughing anyway. That makes for a dark comedy. And they're if you can pull them off, they are very compelling, and people tend to remember them longer, even though it's not just a lot of what I've done in my career, which is just in entertainment. Entertainments are great. They certainly have their place. But if you can create something that has a little more substance to it, it tends to stay with an audience longer.
And so aside from the nature of human greed, what do you hope the audience will leave Windfall musing about in terms of themes and big sort of existential issues?
You know, what would be fun, I think, is for people to just go out thinking, well, what would I do? What would I do if I was in that office? Who would I be? Would I be the best me, or would I be just getting through it, or would I kind of give in and be the worst me? And if I was in that situation, if I really thought I had made an investment that I couldn't afford to make and somebody was cheating me, to what lengths would I go? Where would my rage, or where would my injustice or desperation lead me? If you can actually leave there going, huh, I wonder how I'd handle this if it were me, that's a great experience to have, whether it be a play, a book, or whatever it may be. If it leaves you thinking, how does that world affect me, that's fantastic.
Have you figured it out for yourself?
I often think, you know, I haven't done it in this scenario. I have been, for better or worse, privy to people who have had health issues that I think are debilitating and horrifying. And I know what I'm like. If I have a headache, I'm cranky. And they have really big issues. And they're fantastic. They treat people wonderfully. They're optimistic and outgoing about life. And they get through it. They eat the discomfort, and they deal with it, and they remain good people. And I always go, I think I would be the most miserable so-and-so on the planet. I can't. I would hope to rise to their level, but I have a feeling I may not have it in me. So I don't know what I would do in an office like this. I would hope that I would never have to take this job.
Jason Alexander, thank you so much. You're in Little Rock for a few weeks directing Windfall. A pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, Sarah.
A report from Sarah Weitz-Kotacek of the KUAR News Team. Thank you so much, Sarah. Windfall opens at 8 p.m. Friday, June the 10th, on REP's main stage in Little Rock, with a champagne meet-and-greet post-performance in the REP Theatre lobby. For tickets, call 501-378-0405 or online therep.org. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.